What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? Polytalk is back to unpack the big questions, like why is it hard to get medicine you need in the Pacific?
It came to a point where he was admitted where he got blood poisoning. He needed antibiotics for that, and that was not available.
Join me, Scott Whitehair, on Polytalk.
Search up Polytalk in your favorite podcast app to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
This is Stories from the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia.
Hello and welcome to Stories from the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Bobby McCumber. In 2020, one breakthrough writer rose above thousands of entries to win the Emerging Writers Competition for SBS, Australia's second public broadcaster, capturing attention with a voice that was sharp, honest and deeply original. She didn't stop at writing. She also stepped behind the camera to write and direct her first short film, Chicken, a story that blends humour, identity and resilience in a way that's both entertaining and thought-provoking. Born in Papua New Guinea, she moved to Australia as a child with her mother, and that experience of growing up between the two cultures continues to shape the story she tells today. A creative voice to watch in Australia, Alana Hicks, welcome to Stories from the Pacific.
Hi, Bobby. Great to be here.
Great to have you. Now, look, Alana, your name is a fusion of your parents' names, Alan and Anna. What does it mean to you to be literally carrying them both in your name?
No, it's a beautiful idea. I never really thought about carrying their legacy within me. I don't know about that story, Bobby. It's like, you know how parents kind of create myths? And I think that might have been a retrofitted story, because it's like Alana is a name that exists, you guys. Like, you know, thousands of Scottish girls with big ears and thin blonde hair are called Alana. Like, I'm not unique in that way. But, it is really special to me that I do carry my mother's name and my father's name in my in my title. I guess I just never really thought about that, to be honest. The power of it. But there is power in a name. And there is, I think, significance in claiming that power. I guess I've never really claimed it, but maybe from today onwards I'll actually have more pride in the fact that I am named after both my mother and father. It was always just an anecdote to me. I never really thought about it, but it's beautiful. And also, you know, the naming traditions in PNG and other Pacific places, we really do hold on to names, and names are a really big deal, because they're a continuation, I suppose, of legacy. And you know, like it's quite funny, because in a lot of the people, like names in PNG, they're usually named after language names are like objects. So someone would be called, like, you know, the literal translation of a mug or something, but it's about the lyricism of the title, just because it actually translates to an everyday object, like, you know, toilet seat. It can actually still sound quite lyrical and beautiful. So it's very much about the sound. There's something different going on linguistically in island languages that I would love to one day interrogate.
What can you tell me about your father?
probably more about what I can't tell you.
Why is that?
Dad was he was an intelligence agent for probably maybe 30 years at least. I probably can't say too much about what other stuff he did, but he was quote unquote a spy, I guess, in the 80s, 90s and 2000s, and only really he retired about 15 years ago or 20 years ago when he finally came to Australia. So Mum and I moved without him. So he stayed in Port Moresby for work, as did my older siblings, because they all had their own lives. So one of them was already here. And Mum and I came alone. But so he's led a duplicitous life. And I think anybody who's been a child of someone who's worked in intelligence or in any kind of work where they can't, well, they're not allowed to tell you what they do on a day-to-day basis, will tell you that sometimes it's hard to crack the veneer of the parent or the love, whoever it is that you're talking about, partner, I suppose. And sometimes you just never quite know if you really know them, or there are parts of them that you don't know and parts of them you will never know. But there are parts of himself that he showed potentially only me, and that would be the parts that loved comic books and the parts that loved film and TV and jokes. You know, he's a wonderful storyteller and a wonderful joke teller. So, and anecdotes, and he can quote poetry and he can quote Shakespeare. So that kind of, I have access to that part of him. And as a child of a complicated person, you have to accept what you can get and let go of what you don't have access to.
I heard a funny description of you describing your dad as a professional liar.
Yo, yeah. I don't know when I came up with that, but yeah, my dad is a professional liar. No, legit. He was a professional liar, and mum was a recreational liar because of the oral storytelling tradition of oral histories and the spoken word and how much that is actually a really important part of connection, of bonding between, you know, parent and child or between people within community, telling of story and you know, the morals and the messages and the, you know, like she'll tell me a horrifying story, a terrible story of struggle and pain and you know, hopelessness, and then be like, it's okay, you know, it's okay. And you're like, man, you should be in like mad trauma therapy. But I think that the telling of the story is actually the therapeutic part of it. Mm. And the sort of recognition or having someone bear witness to your life and your turmoil. I just happen to write it down, make some money off it. Nah, jokes, I'm poor.
So speaking of writing, in 2020, you won the SBS Emerging Writers Competition for your essay, Medium Beige. It's an incredible piece about identity and survival. Your story reflects on your life as early as 10 years old, recounting a frightening moment in Port Moresby. Can you tell us about that experience?
Yeah. I was reflecting on that recently, actually, because, yeah, it was a traumatic experience, I suppose. I mean, being held hostage by a gang of machete-wielding gang members will do that. But it was actually fine. Now, this is the same thing that I was talking about. Mom's, yes. You know, like, ah, terrible, terrible. That's fine. Because, and I'll tell you why it's fine. In that incident, just a brief summary of it, you know, Mum and I were coming home. I used to go to after-school care. She'd have to pick me up quite late, come back to the house, fences, la la la. Like, but I used to get out of the car and open the gates up, and then she would drive in and then close the security gate, go inside. This particular time, there was a group of men who'd seen us. It was an opportunistic attack, and as I had opened the gate, I was standing at the gate, and they ran inside the compound, or ran inside our house. Sorry, it wasn't a compound. Ran inside and surrounded her car and were beating on the window, telling her to get out. And they had knives, you know, machete, and I, in that moment, remember having that thought of, okay, if I stand here and they see me, I become, I could get attacked. I could get into trouble. So I ran around the house into the back door, into the kitchen, and I called the police. And I think that I must have been drilled into, like, this must have been drilled into me. And my primary school as well, we used to have regular kind of riot training things. So I think I was just prepared. And what I've understood about that kind of stuff later on, more recently, is that when something bad happens to you, as terrible as it is, if you can find a way to have agency or a way to sort of stand up for yourself, you feel empowered and you don't feel so helpless. And so even though it was a scary situation and everything else, and you know, mum had a knife held to her neck. She got out of the car, by the way. She got out of the car because she knew that I was right there. So she actually, you know, I look back and I understand that she was trying to draw attention away from me, because she knew that she didn't want anything to happen to me, obviously. So I understand now that the act of calling the police was something within me that allowed me to feel empowered and strong, and that I was able to take action. And as a result, I don't know that it didn't negatively impact me. It certainly was a very strong visceral memory, but I feel proud of the fact that my parents had sort of helped me have that sense of resilience and action Oh, by the way, though, I didn't know our address. So, hilariously, I couldn't tell the cops. I gave them the P.O. box.
So they walked up to the post office. What happened then?
We're here to collect the mail. They stole a whole bunch of Australian currency because I was about to go to Australia the following week. I used to go to travel between Sydney and Port Moresby by myself as a kid. So they stole a bunch of Australian currency, which, again, was totally useless to them. I must tell you, I feel compassion for those attackers because it was just they needed money. They stole the car. They, you know, I think the mom got the car back. But when people are driven to that sort of thing, it's because of their own sense of hopelessness and circumstance that they are a victim of as well.
It's incredible that you have empathy for those people. You actually moved from Port Moresby without your father or your siblings into your grandfather's in a wealthy Sydney suburb. Even though you had had those experiences of coming over, you know, for school holidays, it must have been a huge culture shock for you to actually be living there. What was that like?
Yeah, even though it was a wealthy suburb and gentrified, it wasn't at the time when Papa bought it. He bought it because it was a worker's cottage at the time, and then that whole area just shifted into this wealthy space over the course of the 70, 80 years that he was there, the family was there. But the culture shock, I suppose, came in the form of me being able to visibly witness how this society treated my black mother. So, you know, she's got a lot of visible traditional tattoos on her arms, and she doesn't change. She doesn't shapeshift like I do. You know, you sort of, you're, you know, what's that thing?
Like a similar
code switch.
Code switch.
You know, when you code switch. It's almost like you just change the channel so that you can be the white voice for that context. So I'm able to do that, obviously. Like, it's just you shift between modes because, like the way I am, the way I used to be when I was at high school and primary school and whatever, or with my friends, it's not the way that I was allowed to be at home or with my aunties or with my family, because you are just a little bit different in some ways. And I haven't really I don't know intellectually why that is or how that happens, but I know it's true of most people who are cross-cultural kids, third culture kids. So, you know, it was heaps of racism. She wasn't allowed to join the golf club despite being an incredible golfer. You know, she probably would have been an elite athlete in another time. She played representative squash and could do all of that stuff. Very, very good athlete, as was a lot of my siblings. But yeah, mum wasn't allowed to go to she wasn't allowed to join the golf club, which was weird because she could pay the fees and we lived down the street, but he wouldn't let her join. There's things I don't know, obviously, but I saw the way people looked, because you just look. I get it. That's human. Early 90s in very, very white, leafy, affluent suburb, and you've got this, you know, brown lady walking down the street making a lot of noise with this scrawny, weird kid who's terrified of everyone and everything. I was probably more scared in Australia, to be honest. I don't know what I mean by the word scared exactly, but then I was in Port Moresby with the violence and the fear around. In Port Moresby, I was more reticent to come forward in Australia because I was afraid to be myself here, to be honest, a little bit.
Speaking of your mother, you are actually with your mother celebrating her birthday. What are some of the things that you love about your mum?
She's got a funny laugh. Oh, and she's just kind of bratty sometimes in the funniest way. Like, last week I did call her a spoiled brat, in laughing, like we talk to each other like that. And then today I said, all right, Queen Bee, because of her birthday and whatever. And she's like, last week you said I was a spoiled brat. Today I'm your queen. Which am I? And I was like, mate, you contain multitudes, okay? That's how it is. It's all right. You're allowed to be both. In fact, they go hand in hand, to be honest. You know, what I love about mum is just the sort of truthfulness. Mum has a lot of residual trauma from a lot of the stuff that went down with her, and that's probably may not completely heal in her lifetime. And for my own sense of peace, I have to accept that the ways that she has been sometimes, which weren't always beneficial to me, but that's okay. Maybe, you know, single parent and a kid, sometimes you kind of have this dynamic that is less about parent and child and more about, caretaker kind of situation. So, yeah, that can be a bit confusing and boundary crossing, but you know, I love her, and I love all our strong Black women. I love them all because I understand what the exclusion, the systemic exclusion that happens to this day, to our most vulnerable and our most marginalized. So people need to wake up to the inequality and injustice that persists.
You finish Medium Beige with a powerful line about no longer caring about blending in, but instead that you only hope to resemble your mother. Can you talk about the moment when writing this closing line and what that line means to you now?
You know, where that line came from was how my mum used to also end her stories with me. And, you know, we talked about it earlier, where it would be this intense tale or whatever it might be, or a complicated, nuanced conversation. And it always came back to pride. And it's not pride in the ego sense of like, I'm so good, I'm so amazing. It was like, it was this kind of knowing of self-value and allowing that to be, you know, the anchor, I think. Like going, you know what, there's nothing I can change externally about how others or the world see me, but I can at least hold my own sense of self and value. And that's the only thing that kind of, you know, you need really, is just to go, hey, I'm worth it. I'm worth showing up for every day. I'm worth being the best person I can be for my kids or for my partner or for my friends, for my family. But I need to believe that I'm worth holding space in that way, you know, because it's hard. It's hard to show people yourself.
You're listening to Stories from the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Bobby McCumber and I'm speaking with Alana Hicks. Your short film Chicken, it's autobiographical and it continues to resonate even years after its release. What emotions come up for you when you see its impact is still growing today?
Mostly confusion, I suppose. Well, it's on these, it's on a kind of curriculum, education curriculum in Germany, and they've really picked it up and run with it. And so every kind of 6 months I get a check in euros. It's not a check, it's in my PayPal account. But I'm like, what's going on over there that they're resonating with this? And I'm going to do a name drop here. Leah Purcell, who's one of my absolute, you know, creative heroes. Yeah. She was a gentle mentor on Chicken, like, because she sort of knows my sister-in-law. And so I managed to hook up a conversation for her to read the script before I shot it. And it was hard to catch her, but it was like, so it was towards the end of pre-production. We're quite close to shooting. And so she read the script and we had a phone call. And she made a suggestion about shifting one line from the mother who originally had this line to the daughter. And I'll tell you what the line is. The mum, in the original script, the mother was the one who said, I didn't get the chicken, right? Because actually in real life, that's what happened. Mum and I went up to the shops and the whole thing was pretty much the same, except she was the one who said, I didn't get the chicken. So for people who haven't seen the film, it's about, you know, a mother being overcharged at the local shops and her daughter, mixed race daughter, going and kind of having to fight that battle. And this scenario actually happened at the local Franklin's, used to be called. Now it's IGA. But anyway, and mum said that line, and I was the one in real life who said, Mum, we got the chicken, you know, what are you talking about? But so she kind of flim-flammed the chicken getting it, and that's how I wrote it. And then Leah read it, and then her craft, and this has stayed with me forever, you know, when you're doing something autobiographical or semi-autobiographical, you have to actually be over it emotionally before you can kind of reflect on it or write about it. critically or professionally, because it's harder to apply craft to something that you are emotionally invested in a writing sense. So Leo was like, give that line to the daughter. Suddenly we have an active protagonist and we have a change in character. So, you know, in a short film or in any kind of creative work, movies, you'll see this all the time. The protagonist needs to be active. They need to be making choices, and they need to kind of, not need to, they can shift over the course of a work. So they start one way with one attitude or one feeling state, and they move to another one at the end. Either the person changes, the character changes, or the context changes, the world around them changes, or someone else close to them. So either way, something usually shifts, you know, within the in a kind of narrative or character motivation way. So Leah was like, you know, give it to that. And she was just left it with me. You know, a good mentor never tells you what to do. They allow you to sit and ruminate on things. And so then I rang my producer and I was like, hey, I wrote a new version of this script. And my producer, Selena, was like, no, I don't want to hear that. We're not doing any changes. And I said, just read it. Like, sent her the new version of the script a couple of days out from shooting. And she's like, rings me back. She's like, yeah, it's better. It's much better. Yeah, it actually works now. We actually have a film now. And it was like, we were this close to having something that felt like it didn't really have a potential climax, like a narrative climax, because I had been too close to it, potentially too close, too slavish to the real story. But when Leah said that, and because of her incredible story mind, I was like, oh God, so many things clicked into place. You can speak about your life and your, and whatever, but you still need to dramatize it for an audience, and you still need to allow it to have impact for them in a way that is to do with craft and the great classic traditions of storytelling. So I look at that film now and I think, my goodness, lessons, learnings. I look at it and I say, thank you. Thank you to the gods of storytelling. And thank you to myself for persisting in that time when I was getting absolutely nothing. And I just kept pushing up that hill going, someone give me a shot here. And I got that opportunity and it kind of ran away. And that's the only thing I've done to this day where I've been allowed to write and direct my own work. Everything I've directed since then has been other people's writing. So I do hope that I'll be given an opportunity to write and direct my own material again.
I watched Chicken, absolutely loved it. And now hearing you speak of that moment, it was a twist that was unexpected and I loved where it took us. So that's great to hear. And now, one of your most recent works, Moni, meant collaborating closely with a story that wasn't yours to claim. How do you navigate the collaborative space, ensuring that authenticity for the storyteller is still there while still leaving your creative imprint?
What a beautiful question, Bobby. I love that, because collaboration in, well, screen storytelling is paramount, because you have to trust other people to come to the party with their skills, and you have to hope that they trust you to bring your skills to the project as well. So Tafia Pelisasa was the writer, creator, showrunner of Moni. On SBS right now, you don't want to know. And Fia is an incredible storyteller, and that was their story. And I, when you're a director for hire, which is essentially what I was on that, even though it was very close to me and we did a lot of the development in the early days, you are a facilitator, a sort of vision keeper. I'm trying to keep the integrity of their vision and not put too much of my own certain things that I want to put in there. You have to let go. And the same thing happened with a couple of other, you know, projects that I directed as well. I think PM's Daughter was another one I did, and Pacific Adrift, where you go, what is the actual vision of this project? What is the end result? And how am I going to work towards that goal with everybody? All of us need to be on the same page about what kind of story we're telling. Otherwise, it goes off the rails and we're telling different stories. So the things that I bring, and also hire me for my skills, that's what I have asked and that's what I've done. I can be funny. I can work well with actors and bring out good performances. I can do good shot lists. And so those, when I watch Moni now, and framing, I mean, when I watch Moni now, I'm like, I can see where I am. Do you know what I mean? I can see it in my extreme close-ups, because that's one of the things that I love doing is close-ups and comic moments. So, and I love watching comedy play out in mids and things like this. And I just love having actors be like their best selves on screen. If we can get that, that's what I want. So, you know, that's all I can hope to bring to the table and to the project. And quite frankly, Bobby, I've stepped on a lot of toes too, though. Like, I can be super annoying in a collaborative context just because I get too passionate. I think you can probably tell from this conversation. I can go on and on.
Well, you've got a lot to tell. You're also working on a book, Home is a Foreign Country. What does that title mean to you, and what emotional territory are you exploring in it?
Home is a Foreign Country is a play on the opening line of a book called The Go-Between. And the original line is, the past is a foreign country. They do things differently there. My father, that was one of his favorite books. And I tried to read that book, but I got as far as the first line. but no, I will read it. It's somewhere on the bookshelf. But Home is a Foreign Country means to me that the relationship that I have with my home, Asples, PNG, is, well, firstly, it's a foreign country, so it's a play on that. But it's also, it's a memory. It's an invention of my mind. My childhood is, you know, it was just a sort of construction of, you know, thoughts and feelings and interactions with people. And it's all such a vague cloud of quotes and ideas and moments that I can never revisit it. It's not real. Do you know what I mean? Like, it doesn't exist. My interpretation of how that was is gone. So I love playing with the idea of memory and how we sort of reconstruct our memory to suit the narrative that we want to tell ourselves. And that's for better or worse. And so that's just the relationship I have with my childhood, the relationship I have with my place where I was born and the home that I love and my culture. It's that tenuous grasp we all have on our personal histories and what we make of those past events and how we choose to interpret them for our purposes now. I want to take strength and I want to take resilience from my history. And I want to leave behind feelings of loneliness or abandonment because they don't serve me anymore. You know, they don't serve my relationship with my kids, you know. And so I with my kids, I'm here for them. I'm trying not to be so absent, although it happens because sometimes I'm working my butt off. But just remembering that they need to know that I'm here for them, which is sometimes I didn't necessarily feel like that as a kid growing up, you know.
What do you hope young Pacific and culturally diverse creatives can take away from your journey?
Well, no, I don't know that they should take anything from my journey. I guess it's anybody's experience of life is totally unique to them. I think for young Pacific people today, especially people in PNG, I want them to know that it's not you, it's the world. Like, it's, you know, this, we are shackled in many ways. There's a lot of things that we can't hold responsibility for but that you still have to fight for somehow, you know, sovereignty, like land rights and climate justice. Like, there is just so much on the plate of young people these days that I wish that it were different for them. I wish that it could have been better by now for them. I mean, wishing is kind of futile, right? But I yearn for a better future for our young people. I do. And yeah. I'm sorry for them. I feel bad.
Alana Hicks, thank you so much for joining me from New South Wales and for being so open in sharing your incredible gift for storytelling. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you so much, Bobby. My gratitude. Bamawuta.
That was Alana Hicks, writer, director, creative from Papua New Guinea. You've been listening to Stories from the Pacific. I'm Bobby McCumber. To hear more stories about unique and incredible people from the Pacific, just search for Stories from the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. If you or someone you know has an interesting story to share, you can email us at storiesfromthepacific@abc.net.au. This story was produced on the lands of the Yuggera and Turrbal people. I am hosting this story on the lands of the Kaurna people.